On Tucson Business Radio X now, join Michael Shoup and Carolyn Goldschmidt from HOA Law with another in-depth program and interesting guests with Community Law and your host, Michael Shoup.
Welcome, welcome everyone to another edition of Community Law, live and streaming from Stewart Title Studio in Tucson, Arizona. It's our monthly program covering topics and trends in the world of HOAs. Joined again, as always, by my colleague, Carolyn Goldschmidt. How are you, Carolyn?
Very well, Michael. Good afternoon.
So we are going to be talking about roads today. The fun and twisting turns of street and road issues in community associations. For everyone out there listening, if this is the first time you're listening, Carolyn and I are both partners of the law firm of Goldschmidt Shoup, and we provide legal services focused on real estate and common interest community law here in Tucson, Arizona, and throughout Southern Arizona. We are very happy to be joined today by two more guests from the HOA industry. First, Craig Pratt of Sunland Asphalt. Hello, Craig.
Hello. Thank you for having me.
And Steve Rabish of Oversee. Hello, Steve.
Yes, hey, Mike. Yeah, thank you for having me.
No, absolutely. How are your days going? Steve, you had a bit of a drive-in today, correct?
Sure. Loving the roads here. Talk about all these people moving here, and one little thing on the side of the street can delay you almost an hour and a half.
Yeah.
Well, you leave early and you plan for things, you know?
That's right. Well, I thought it was appropriate. We were talking about parking today, and you were looking at being parked on eastbound I-10 for a couple hours. So,
oh my gosh, yeah.
Only appropriate. So, Carolyn, streets and roads.
Yes.
I guess a simple topic. Is it true that all roads in HOA planned communities and HOA operated communities are owned by the HOA?
No, there are many instances where there are publicly owned streets running through an HOA. And one of the common myths that owners and residents have is that an association cannot control parking on public streets. That's not entirely true in Arizona.
Okay. So what would then be what's the legal basis if they're public streets? Where does the authority to control parking come from?
Well, like most authority for HOAs, the authority is in the CC&Rs, augmented often by parking rules that are adopted by boards. But the public street issue is a little complicated by a law that was adopted in 2011, I believe.
It's 2014, December 31st,
I think. Oh, well, yes, but I think that was the date after which any CC&Rs needed to be recorded to apply to the law. And the law is basically that an HOA cannot control parking or any other activity on public streets in declarations of CC&Rs recorded after December 31st, 2014.
Okay. Now, that would mean that all of the existing HOAs we see in Arizona that predate that date still have, if in their CC&Rs, the ability to control parking.
Correct.
Okay.
Correct.
And I guess you mentioned maybe some myths about, are there common myths or misconceptions?
Well, there are a couple of others. One is that if somebody has a commercial truck that they use in their business, that an association can't enforce parking rules. The most common, you know, a lot of associations only allow parking in garages and on driveways. And in some cases, oversized trucks don't fit in a garage. Actually, my favorite is when an owner lives in a dwelling unit with a garage and goes out and buys a truck that won't fit in the garage, knowing that the association has a rule about it.
Right, right. Yeah, I have several acquaintances who have fallen into a trap of sorts of owning big trucks. It seems to be something that's much more common today to own large trucks. And you move into these planned communities with very short driveways. And it's interesting, as long as the declarant, the original developer, was in control of the association, you know, they were parking on the street, parking over the sidewalk. And once it went into transition, all of a sudden there was kind of a rash of those letters going around saying, you have to park your large trucks appropriately. So plenty of fodder for dispute and discourse. I guess maybe Steve, we could start with you just briefly. Tell us a little bit about Oversee.
Sure. So again, my name is Steve, and I founded Oversee Security. So we specialize in unarmed guard service and parking enforcement. So when we are out most times at night, we are sighting, as you can probably tell, we're overseeing the property, the eyes and the ears, making sure that everything is safe and sound. So we could report a garage that's open with no lights on, with no cars in it, to a gate that's not operating, to a sprinkler head that's gushing water, to a handicapped car parked without a handicap placard, inactive permit, landscape parking. So, I mean, as you know, HOAs are all about consistency and uniform to mitigate the risk and to maximize homeowner values. That's why we're all here. And that is basically what we do, is we collect the data. The data then goes out to the property management company through proprietary technology, meaning we created the software. So we've added some really nice features I may mention later. But that data, they are then deciding. And sometimes our data goes to court. So that's half the reason why we're paid, is because they can rely if something is contested.
Yeah, I have to say, it seems like your service really fits a need for many associations that have needs to control or enforce parking. Are there other businesses like Oversee that provide this service?
Sure. No. I mean, now that we compete against security agencies, I mean, I'm technically up against publicly traded companies. But the smaller ones, to answer your question, the most direct, there's probably one or two that are very close to what we do. But again, you know, we work with 48 different management companies, and we're at 182 properties as of this morning. So, the technology and the way that we approach the industry is really what separates us.
Yeah. Well, so, and you got your start up in Phoenix metro area?
Correct.
Okay. So what was kind of was there a transition down to Tucson that you found?
Yeah. August of 2017, I worked 6 months to get my first contract. So that was that came into contract August 1st, 2017, so a little over a year ago. And now we've swelled to 9 properties, including one of the largest here, which is 3,214 units in Midville Park. So security and parking there. So it's a blend.
It's a blend.
And some properties we're just doing inspections. So property managers, again, keeping everything uniform, they will do day inspections. We are kind of like them, but at night, in marked vehicles with LED lights, dash cams, uniform, and so forth, because you can imagine what would happen at, you know, between 2 and 3 in the morning if we're out there, you know, people may get a little upset and wonder what we're doing. So the more visible we are, the more they know that we're a third party and we're here for a purpose.
So you mentioned kind of different services. You have this parking enforcement. You mentioned other kinds of enforcement.
Sure. So unarmed guard service. So technically we can hire off-duty policemen as well as armed guards, but, you know, we don't really take on those kind of communities that need that. So safety is number one. By all means, we are not the police, and no one should be except for the police. And, you know, the biggest weapon that we have been trained, because we've paid for some de-escalation service from ex-police chiefs and around Phoenix, and the biggest weapon you have is your mouth. So the act of consideration, respect, right off the bat, whether someone is contesting this violation or they're on drugs or sleepy, you know, unhappy, whatever it may be, things tend to escalate very quickly at night. So the more that we can de-escalate, with tactics, and again, we are unarmed. So that is the way that safety can, you know, come to the forefront. The whole business is built around that. You know, we won't take on contracts where there are, you know, major problems. I mean, that's something for the police to deal with, because, you know, they have resources not like us, as you can imagine.
Sure. Best
we're ability. Just talking about parking overnight on the street.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
You know, you would be amazed what we see. I mean, just like the other night, guys running down the street with a baseball bat, hooting and hollering. I mean, I can talk about a property that we showed up doing some free service to earn it, and we show up at about 2:30 in the morning, and there's literally 40-plus people gathered, you know, in a part of Phoenix. And so let's just say, we didn't want to, you know, take that on.
Yeah.
It's part of our job, absolutely, to confront and to be confronted. But at the end of the day, you know, lives are a little bit more important.
Right.
So treat it as such.
It's barking. It's right. barking. Well, I wanted to ask, in the time you've been operating, do you have any kind of data or statistics on how your operations may have affected an association's bottom line as far as cost of enforcement or the number
Absolutely.
Of violations?
Yeah, great question. So the way that we usually, the pitches that we present, that within 60 days, you will see positive noticeable change. I can tell you that we've been doing this for some time, and I've seen the initial worst situations and situations that aren't that bad initially. But two months, 60 days is the point where we are able to perhaps trim down patrols. So if we're there 16 times a month, if we're there every day, sometimes we're there 62 times a month. But there's an original cost. We can call it a startup cost. Mm-hmm. But after that 60th day, we tend to review the data, and the software that we've created will actually tell us, is the problem getting better or worse? And from there, we are able to decrease patrols, obviously assuming board approval. And then we will save the money that way. And you wonder why is that a good business plan? I can tell you that our marketing expenses are 1.62% of our overall revenue, so they're very small. So people, you know, like any good idea, product or service, people talk about that. And sometimes right. the best ideas are the ones not advertised.
Right.
So,
thank you for that introduction. I think there are a half dozen topics we'll
sure.
touch on there. I was going to toss it over to Craig here. Craig, you're with Sunland Asphalt. What's Sunland's story here in Tucson?
Well, Sunland has been in business since 1979. I've been with them almost 17 years now, and we're one of the biggest maintenance and reconstruction of existing parking lots and streets in Tucson and in Phoenix and Vegas and Denver and Albuquerque.
Okay,
so we're in the Southwest.
And so you're a regional company then. Is HOA work something you do across the region, or does it differ depending on location?
No, we chase after HOA work. It's one of our bread and butter businesses that we like to go after. So there's a lot of things that we offer HOAs when it comes to road maintenance or reconstruction or even the in-between spaces between seal coating and a overall pulverization and pave or a mill and pave. So we run the whole gamut of what we can do for the streets.
Right. So I guess do you have a portfolio of HOA clients in town, or where does your region run?
The Tucson region basically runs south of Casa Grande all the way up to Sholo, all of southern Arizona for the most part. And then our Phoenix office goes north of Casa Grande up to Flagstaff. And then our Vegas office takes care of most of the western Arizona okay. and Flagstaff area and Las Vegas, Nevada. And then our Albuquerque office obviously has New Mexico. And then our Denver office has Colorado.
Okay. So are you then out of the Tucson office?
I am out of the Tucson office. I've been here for 17 years.
Okay. And I guess what's interesting to Carolyn and I many times is we obviously have a certain kind of relationship as legal counsel for HOAs, and we get to see some of the dynamics of how boards operate with, you know, it's common for there to be five directors, five different individuals for different takes. What have been some of your experiences dealing with a group of voluntary board members when having to deal with something as maybe expensive as a paving project?
It's not so much of a challenge. I mean, I love that part of the job where I get to go out there and meet these folks. And it's more about educating them. It is not about going out and selling them a job. It's actually taking their streets and educating them on what their streets are doing today, what we plan on doing it to make the streets last longer, and what they should do for those streets in the future. So we try to get them a plan, not only for today's problems, but how they can continue in getting the most of the life out of the streets, with the proper maintenance program, that they can get the better life out of out of their roads.
And that goes right along with the standard of care that directors need to follow in making decisions.
Absolutely. I mean, the biggest things that I've always said tear up our streets out here are the sun, the rain, and board members not making a decision. So that will end up cost them a lot of money in the long run. So, and you also want to be sure you pick the right product, not necessarily look at the lower right-hand corner and assume we've all bid you the same thing or the right answer. I'm not saying I won't be low sometimes, but that's what you have to take into consideration is the better bang for your buck over the long haul. You know, asphalt is expensive, and prices vary. You know, it's a very volatile market. So putting off today may cost you, you know, quite a bit more by just putting it off a year. So that's what you need to take into consideration too.
All right. Well, you are listening to Community Law on Tucson Business Radio at TucsonBusinessRadio.com. We've just jumped into a conversation with Steve Ravish of Oversee and Craig Pratt of Sunland Asphalt. Craig, I wanted to kind of follow up a bit on some of that topic area you were just discussing. You said that sometimes the board's own inaction can be a major contributor to road issues. Is there, I guess, a timeline for proper street maintenance?
I kind of call it like the turkey timer. If you start to see more gray in your streets than you do black, then it's probably time to at least give us a call and let's do an evaluation. If you're starting to see a lot of cracks in your street, you know, that's the gateway for potholes to form. So you want to crack seal those up. So a lot of what we do too is temperature specific. So you want to do certain things in the cold time of year and certain things in the warmer time of year. So we're coming up on the crack fill season. So this is when you want to crack seal your streets right now to get to stop basically potholes from forming through the winter rains. And it's probably your best money-saving tactic in the long run to ward off costly remove and replaces and your potholes that you have to take care of that are not only a safety issue, but they also damage cars and take away from the property value.
Is there kind of a known point of no return in the asphalt area, if you're starting to see these signs in the roads, you know, crack seal's not going to help?
Yes, and that's all on an individual basis, too. I mean, there's really not every parking lot and every street is different for the most part. You know, how it's been taken care of in the past, how it's, you know, what's happening today, and what do we need to do for it. But we do offer a lot of services and that'll help put that off, you know, as long as we possibly can. That's the whole goal, is to get the longest life out of your asphalt that you can. People that are adamant about seal coating, I'm still seal coating roads that are 20 to 25 years old. And then I've also replaced roads that were just put down 7 or so years ago.
Wow.
So it all depends on the amount of care that they do. And that kind of goes back about not doing something to put it off. It will eventually come back and get you.
Now, is there a such thing as road care? Are there proactive steps that an association can take to care for their roads versus just maintaining them when they're needed?
I would suggest sweeping. Sweeping is a big one. You don't want to do it too often. What I recommend is that you do it after the monsoon season and after the rainy season in the winter. Now, in between those two big sweepings, I would highly suggest that you talk to your landscaper and see if they can kind of keep the roads in, you know, pretty good shape at the same time, because the sand and the people's, you know, aggregate coming out of their yards during the rain or the sand coming up out of the asphalt acts as sandpaper. So it prematurely wears out the road. So if you keep them clean, like anything else, they have a tendency to last longer and look better.
Well, I know one thing that Carol and I run into with during the development stages of a homeowners association community, or maybe in a custom or semi-custom home where lots are being developed at different times. There's always that question of, well, this house is under construction or this lot is under construction and dirt is running into the streets, and we're worried about what damage that causes, the financial ramifications of that. And it's always sometimes hard to put a value on that if you're looking at maybe seeking a remedy against that owner who's not, you know, keeping up his lot. Have you run into situations where you've helped to provide some estimates for putting a value to that?
Absolutely. What I have done in the past, especially when there's being a new home built in a neighborhood like that, a lot of people want to put off sealing the whole neighborhood because of this one or two homes that are in there that are under construction. Well, I advise against that. It's like putting a drop cloth down when you're painting or you're doing some kind of construction in your home. You want to protect the big investment. There are only two little small portions, but I would suggest that the HOA board, you know, keep in constant contact with those general contractors to help keep their streets clean. And then as, you know, maybe when they are finally done, that, you know, call me and I'll give them a proposal or something of that nature to assess what damage was done to the road by the contractor. And it's inevitable that, you know, something will happen. But it's usually just a simple seal coat that okay. You can put over it to cover up their tracks, unless they've gouged it out with some heavy equipment or something like that. But you know, it should be the contractor's responsibility to help maintain what the neighborhood looks like.
Something I've been curious about, a lot of associations are amending their CC&Rs to allow only one trash collection provider in the neighborhood. And the rationale is often that if you use too many providers and they're coming on different days, they're going to damage our roads. Is there any truth to that?
You know, that's been a debate for a long time. My feeling is those roads are designed to take that kind of traffic. And just because you have these big trucks coming in there, they're only going to really hurt the stress areas, being in the turning areas, you know, at intersections. And they'll do a little bit, but the road itself is designed to hold that. Everybody goes, well, you know, your delivery trucks. Well, if you think about delivery trucks, they're just a big hollow truck. You know, They're carrying just light packages. So they look big, but in actuality, they don't weigh that much. But I would say they do a little bit. I can't say they do a whole lot in the way of damage, because the roads are designed to do that. Now, if they're seeing damage on the roads, it may be because of the lack of maintenance.
Right.
You know,
or
that,
maybe
that
a
could
poor
be.
Design.
Say that again?
Poor design. And construction.
Well, lack of maintenance of not seal coating it or keeping up with it where the air breaks. Now, I can't talk about abuse of the trucks. You know, sometimes they try to go from, you know, container to container as fast as they possibly can and leave, you know, little, it almost looks like skid marks where they're stopping at the containers. That I can't, you know, address because that is wrong. They should be taking their time to pick them up, and that does cause damage. You know, and it seems to always show itself after we've seal coated, because it does scar it, but typically it's just a superficial thing, not a structural problem.
Well, I'm wondering, you know, talking about roads, I think speed issues are something that we see often, Carolyn.
Oh, all the time. We're asked, what can we do about speeders?
Right.
On our private roads.
And you know, one of the solutions that inevitably comes up is, well, let's put in speed bumps, right?
I love this topic.
So you've had some experience. What have you done in the past where a board says, okay, Sunland, we want to put in speed bumps, give us a bid?
Okay, that's a great question. The most effective way to slow down speeders with these type things is the simple speed bump, which is typically 18 inches wide by the width of the road and about 3 inches tall. Those are the most effective in slowing people down. Now, you also have what's called speed humps. Speed humps are roughly 12 foot wide in the width of the road. they were mostly designed to use on Pima County roads or city streets because they slow down traffic and they don't slow down emergency vehicles as bad. That was always a big complaint with speed bumps is because of the emergency vehicles, it slows down their response time. So with the speed hump, that was kind of the compromise. The speed hump, once it's learned by the residents that they can go over them fairly fast, become somewhat ineffective. They're expensive. You know, they're not like your little speed bump, which a lot of people don't like those by their house because of people's stuff in the back of the pickup trucks. They hit it a little bit too hard at 2 o'clock in the morning and everything goes flying up and then slams back down in the pickup truck. So they're a noisy solution. But they are the most effective and they are the least expensive to thwart the speeders. And, you know, if safety is involved, speed bumps are the way to go. Nobody likes them, but, you know, that's what's going to keep your children safe versus all the other things.
What's a speed table?
A speed table is another one designed for a higher speed city or county street. They are roughly 12 foot long as an upslope, and then they flatten out for 24 feet, and then they slope back down for 12 feet. They're pretty. As speed bumps go, there's some decorative ones they do, but as for slowing people down, you know, it's a 25 to 35 mile an hour deal. You know, and once again, it's the response time of emergency vehicles. It was just kind of in place to slow them down a little bit. It's not an effective one for residential, and those are the most expensive. They're really pricey. And yet they're the least effective in actually slowing people down.
Well, Carolyn, we get asked about speed bumps. Are there liability concerns associated with speed bumps?
Well, actually, one of the first cases I ever had as a lawyer was in one of the high-end communities here that put in speed bumps. And an attorney who lived there had a Maserati, which is very low to the ground. And just torqued the whole bottom of his car over the speed pump and sued the association. And he actually won because the speed bump wasn't properly engineered. But I thought there was contributory fault because you have to be going pretty fast to tear up your car like that. But there, the biggest liability is potential vehicle damage, but I think the driver is often contributory.
Right. I mean, have you ever been involved, Craig, in a lawsuit where there was a claim that Sunland had engineered a speed bump inappropriately or a speed hump or something?
No, we get that. There are standards, you know, a Pima County standard for speed bumps. So if you follow that standard, you're covered. You know, like you were just talking about, usually people go over them too fast in their sports cars, and they do bottom out. But, wow, it worked.
Yeah.
It slowed you down.
Right.
And that's what they're designed to do. So we have not, to my knowledge, been involved in one of those because we keep to that standard.
So, Steve, do your patrols ever run into speeding cars or –
We do get some RFPs, requests for proposals to monitor the speeding, but I mean, we're not out there with a speed gun or anything, because you know you need data on that, and that's where, you know, if the police catch it, then obviously, I mean, that's that. You can show up to court, but good luck trying to, you know, contest that. But to answer your question, not very often.
Not very
if you
often.
See it like noise disturbance, that's another subjective violation. We have video on our app. I guess we could record that, but how authentic and will that be believed in court? But taking pictures, video is the hardest way we can do it in terms of truth. I mean, they're date and time stamped and they're sent out at a point in time. So even if it's wrong, we can't change it. So it's truth.
I was actually driving in a large association the other day and saw one of those digital monitors telling you how fast you were going. And I thought that's pretty effective.
I know whether it's something deep inside of my brain or not, every time I see one of those, I slow down.
So particularly when it tells you you're going too fast.
Yeah. I quite often see the slow down first, you know, and then I see the 50, 49. But there's something to be said about, and I, in some ways, Steve, this goes back to the point you were making about using your voice, being visible. That sometimes those just the notice to the driver of, hey, this is how fast you're actually going, and maybe everyone around you can see how fast you're going. It has some effect on behavior. I guess Carolyn, to kind of piggyback off of that, associations that maybe larger associations with larger planned communities that want to put up their own signage, their own speed limit signs, or maybe even have volunteers to monitor speeding with guns and things like that. Have you seen anything like that in your experience?
Yes. Actually, one of the largest associations we represent is Age Restricted, and they have a group of volunteers with radar guns.
Oh, wow.
The part that's controversial is that the volunteers get in their golf carts and go chasing after the speeding cars. Something I would really recommend, and it's been criticized, like you're exceeding your authority and acting like the police rather than speed control.
Right, Steve. I assume that you talked about your cars having LED lights and things. You're not chasing anybody.
No. Yeah. Again, the presence will help that.
Yeah.
And there are some communities, and we just picked up one that you know the board was executing. They're doing the nighttime compliance. Gun was pulled on the head, like people standing right behind them. What are you doing with my car? The gun pointed at, like, they're not even being paid for that, you know, and safety, even if you were getting paid, I mean, you're not even trained either. So anyways, yeah, the presence is the biggest thing, yeah. But we won't chase after them. You know, we won't detain people. That's only going to increase risk to the HOA.
Well, fortunately for most people, just bringing a problem
right.
or a violation to their attention will right. change behavior.
That's education, yeah, like you said.
Yeah.
One of my favorite stories is that I've got a couple neighborhoods that put up signs that say only you can prevent speed bumps.
Oh, that's good.
So, you know, if an HOA doesn't want those speed bumps, they put up those signs. And, you know, it's a little bit less expensive.
Well, and it's a very divisive issue.
It really is. It's probably the most controversial things that we do, you know, that comes up at board meetings.
Yeah.
It can get pretty heated.
Well, I wanted to come back around to both of you about how you interact with boards. We started a little bit with you, Craig, about that, but procedures, information you need to get. Want to get a little plug in here for Carolyn and I. Again, you're listening to Community Law with Goldschmidt Shoup, live and streaming from the Stewart Title Studio in Tucson, Arizona. And with almost 40 years combined experience, Goldschmidt Shoup represents over 400 community associations and cooperatives of all sizes and demographics throughout Southern Arizona. Our small, dedicated staff is committed to efficient, effective, and economical legal representation. Whether you have questions about covenant enforcement, have governing documents that may be overdue for revisions or updates, or have a few assessment delinquencies in your community, you can expect that Goldschmidt Shoup will provide quality advice and practical solutions. So, on the topic of practical solutions, practical ideas, I wanted to talk to both of you about how you interface directly with your boards. What kind of information, when you go in to maybe bid a project, do you, if you could stand in front of them today and tell them, this is the information I need to have, what is that?
Doing.
No, go ahead.
I mean, obviously the scope of work, what are the issues? I mean, it's different than hardware. I mean, I guess indirectly you're dealing with human behavior. So everything revolves around that. So what's going on in the community? Is there maintenance issues, architectural, landscape? Obviously the parking, that's strictly humans. The best way that I can earn the business is just being as transparent as possible. Like, we just launched a feature in August after testing, and now boards can see our guards live on property. So obviously if we're not on property, you can't see us, but they will see, and it refreshes every 5 seconds because it's geocoded, but you can see them live. And you can communicate to our nighttime dispatch. And the data now comes in like a live feed. So they can see the activity. And, you know, the first thing, sometimes boards think that they're not getting a good deal and that maybe you're not being fair. But the transparency, and I'm sure with you, is that we, you know, that goes a long way. And ultimately, it's free service. I don't know if Sunland would do that, but I always offer some free service so they can see how the technology works in action. No contract. You just give them a certificate of liability insurances and a couple other items, and we just see if you like it. And for us, it helps us familiarize. So the free service helps.
Are there, I guess, common expectations or things that are anticipated by boards when you go and meet with them? Do they have, are there trends?
Oh, yeah. We just did a proposal for 24 pages long on an RFP. It took me 4 hours, and it's like, wow, these are really specific questions, and I sometimes lose who is the expert because we deal with this day in and day out. So, you know, you don't want to come off like that, but, you know, to consider their items, some of it is just a little overkill. Mm-hmm. It's really too demanding. And, you know, again, we've been doing this a long time. So,
yeah, Mike and I have gotten a couple of RFPs like to 24 pages.
Oh, sure. You know, take you half a day just to get it right.
Right.
Or this throw.
Well, and sometimes just understanding what it is they're asking, you know, what information are they looking for?
Right.
Do you see differences? I don't know if this 24-page RFP was from a managed community or a self-managed community. Do you see differences in expectations between the two?
Yes. So the self-managed, we only have a couple, but those are, you know, public streets. The main violations are just parking on the street, parking on landscape, oversized RVs, boats, trailers. So those are the three. And then obviously anything compliance related, like if there's trash on the street, if it's trash day and it's, you know, a day after, well, they're supposed to put their trash cans in, little items like that. The more intense RFPs come from boards that are ex-military, ex-police. Mm-hmm. So they have, you know, private investigation, they have a background so they can, you know, be a little bit more specific and go really deep in the demands. But yeah, mostly the managed, the larger ones are like that.
Is there an aspect of maybe an expectation from boards that if they are managed, that you integrate with their management company, fit, you know, basically figure out where you might fit into their process or?
Absolutely. So that's a great question. Because what, you know, our software is proprietary, meaning we own it, we created it, so we own it. So a lot of times these enforcement companies, they lease software. There's only a couple big ones and they have majority of the market almost as an oligopoly. So we went another direction. Now, the bad to that is that it's very expensive, and then you got to know what you're doing. But the good is we can do whatever we want with it. So going back to the question, if we are able to link our data into the management company's software, and even sometimes they lease, but that's not my problem, that our data could actually feed into their violation letters, because sometimes they do screenshots. Mm-hmm. So, okay, so two separate, and it's called an API, application programming interface, but our data as it comes in live would be able to feed into their violation letters. That's the benefit. And that's a, you know, if we can get through the red tape, I mean, that's on them, then yeah, it's just basic programming and it's as if it were them.
Yeah.
But you want to, you know, again, some management companies do the nighttime, but safety,
right.
Conflict of interest can also come about too.
Right.
And I know that's a big problem in all communities that have overnight parking rules. Is nobody really wants to be up in the middle of the night patrolling.
Right.
No, there's so much that goes on, and we, you know, we have a nice icon on there. It's one of the smartest things I did in terms of graphics is that, because obviously our trucks are marked and the fleet is all the same. And I put something on there that says always recording. And it's just a big video with a red circle around it. And I'll tell you, so part of our training, obviously, as someone comes to become an employee of guard, that they point that out and it will save them about half the time. The conversation dissolves and they walk away. The other half is it changes the tone because we do have dash cams and we've had to pull that content in several situations.
Right.
But again, the perception.
I'd like that for my car.
Yeah.
Always for your own, recording.
Maybe a little magnet so you can take it off. Sure.
Well, it makes me wonder. I've heard stories about how in Eastern Europe and in places where everybody has a dash cam.
Yeah,
it's just part of daily driving. It's how they caught so many photos of that meteorite or whatever that was falling in because everybody had a dash cam. I wonder if maybe that's kind of where we're heading.
I mean, self, you know, automated driving, you know, that would a question that I would have is that if cars are automated, which probably one day they will be, and self-driving, that would that impact the speed bumps and the roads? If they're not speeding? I mean, have you thought about
it? Well, they should have a GPS and know the speed limit, so it shouldn't affect them at all.
It could be a good thing.
GPS anymore, you're right on top of anywhere.
Yeah.
Well, it definitely is a very interesting, new world. I mean, you hear about in California, there are already legislative changes being proposed to accommodate self-driving cars. And maybe one day in the future, we'll be talking about a special assessment in HOAs to facilitate self-driving cars.
Sure.
It's one of the fun aspects.
No, my favorite will be when you cite someone for a parking violation and they say, well, it wasn't me.
It was my car.
It was my robot.
Right.
He was picking up my food from the fast food restaurant. Well, Craig, I kind of wanted to get some of that same insight from you. Do you find differences between working with self-managed boards and managed boards?
Absolutely. I mean, with managed boards, a lot of the managers want to put out an RFP, and I'm always there to help them do that, because in the asphalt industry, we have what I kind of call our own language. I mean, we even offer a glossary of terms on our website. So there's always this magical thing that when they go out and get bids for a certain HOA, that we all got the same set of rules. And, everybody's the same. So basically what's going to drive the decision making is the lower right hand corner in the price. But, that's where you have to educate and set expectations for boards and managers of what they're actually buying. So you want, as a project consultant, not only I try to educate my customers on what they need to purchase for the long haul, not something that's just a temporary fix. Mm-hmm. Or if that is the case, explain that is only a temporary fix. Yeah. So you kind of have to immerse them in our language of what things actually mean and not assume that they do know what they mean. So setting expectations and going back to, saying a managed community versus an unmanaged, the unmanaged have a lot more time on their hands. So they have a tendency to kind of go overboard on their RFPs mm-hmm. and want everything broken out kind of in separate situations, where a lot of these things kind of go together. Mm. So our biggest challenge is to making sure that everybody's on the same playing field. And I'm always willing to help put an RFP together, so we all speak the same language, and that being the board and all the contractors involved. And then that way they can make an informed decision on who they want to choose for their roads.
Are there questions that you find aren't asked, that you wish that they would ask every asphalt vendor?
Well, that's one of the questions I ask, is basically, what haven't I answered for you? Or here are some questions that you ought to be asking me. In certain situations and all different things, how many tons am I using? What's my dilution ratio? How many am I using a blower to clean my cracks versus a compressor? Big, huge differences in the quality of work. And I mean, our industry can take advantage of people fairly easily. And I'm transparent, when it comes to that. And that's how you're going to gain clients' trust. I mean, I look to partner to people, not just sell them a job, because as asphalt deteriorates, they're going to need my services again. So if we can partner up and we can come up with a plan to get the biggest or longest life from their roads as possible. And it's not always about the price. You really have to look at what you are buying, and don't be afraid to ask questions. I mean, you're probably, no one talks asphalt every day except someone like myself. So, if you do a little YouTube looking and, ask the right questions, what's the difference between a pulverization machine and a mill machine? One of you's doing one thing and one of you's doing the other. Why would I want to pick yours that's more expensive or his that's more expensive, but not know the difference of what these two things do?
Right.
So asking questions, and there is no dumb question. I mean, we, like I said, we speak a language that a lot of people don't speak on a day-to-day basis. So don't be afraid to ask questions. There is no dumb question.
And probably a big red flag would be a company that would be unwilling to answer questions like
Absolutely.
That.
Absolutely.
Well, I don't know if you had anything that you wanted to add, Carolyn.
My famous last words.
Yeah, that's right.
Well, there are a couple of just general things. One is that, like with most areas of governance, it's very helpful to have policies and procedures about parking because often there isn't a lot of detail in the CCNRs. So there are things like inoperable vehicles or vehicles that are creating oil stains and other problems with vehicles that can be addressed in policies and procedures. But parking is certainly an issue that our law firm deals with all the time. And one of the issues is handicapped parking spaces and the fact that associations do have an obligation under the Federal and State Fair Housing Acts to make reasonable accommodation in their policies and procedures so that a handicapped person can live in the community to the same extent as a non-handicapped person. And that sometimes means assigning a special, generally open parking space when requested. So that's something boards are addressed to. And I think the biggest issue that we face is the fact that there often aren't enough parking spaces. There might be rules against parking on the street. I've had one association that didn't even allow parking on the driveway, and that just wasn't tenable. So my advice was change your restrictions, and they did. They amended the CCNRs to allow driveway parking because it's just not reasonable, particularly when families might start out with small children that quickly grow into drivers. You have to accommodate the vehicles of the residents.
All right. Well, with that, we have our standard ending to our show. I need to add our disclaimer that the information shared on our show is not, nor is it intended to be, legal advice, and no attorney-client relationship is intended or created between the listeners and Goldschmidt Shoup. If you are interested in seeking specific advice or legal representation from Carolyn or I, you may contact us at our office at 520-265-4462 or by email at office@gshoalaw.com. We also encourage you to visit our website, www.gshoalaw.com, where you can learn a bit about our firm, our services, and also listen to our broadcast right here on Tucson Business Radio. With that, I wanted to thank again our guests, Craig Pratt and Steve Rabish. Thank you both for being here. Want to let everybody out there listening know that we have your contact information and some biographical information that'll be up on the website on TucsonBusinessRadio.com. Basically just wanted to thank you for joining us today and having a rousing conversation about a topic that maybe people wouldn't necessarily think is at the top of their list. Carol and I also, of course, want to welcome all of you out there listening for bringing us along in your day. We hope that you've taken away something valuable from the show and that maybe you have something to share with your company or your community and hope that you will be able to join us next time. With that, thank you everyone for joining us on Community Law. Bye-bye now.